Piece of Penny Gold there by the Irish Tenors. And friends, you are welcome to the Flannelly Show live. Ah, wait a minute now. Hold on. We have, Turlough McConnell. What is it about Donegal people? Even when you play one tune for them, they want the second one right on the heels of it. You're very welcome, Turlough. How are you?
Great, Adrian. You certainly know how to get right to me by playing the Hills of Donegal.
Yeah. I just want to ask you about your own background, about Donegal, about your, your ambitions. What sent you in this direction?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a long story, but it's the story of my whole life, actually. But what it is for me is Donegal, Buncrana, Inishowen, where I grew up, it has to be the most beautiful part of Ireland. I have no doubt in my mind about that. It was long before the Troubles. It was one of the most beautiful little tourist resorts in the country. And I grew up there. I had the privilege of growing up there. With a great family, and we were all involved with tourism and bars and cafes and shops and all of that business. And we'd see the busloads of tourists coming through from everywhere across the globe, mostly from North America. We'd get the tour buses in. And it was kind of like, it was moving ahead to be a kind of a Killarney up there in Donegal. But then the trouble of the North broke out in the 60s, as you well know. Yeah. And then that story all changed. And I guess if I ever had an ambition, Adrian, as a young person when that was happening, it was to, first of all, to try to see what I could do to, in my own very modest way of trying to help change that situation. And then secondly, to keep spreading the word about how great Donegal is and bringing people back to Donegal. And I'm still doing that.
I would love to dwell more on that, but just give us the short version. For those who would say, well, wait a minute, Donegal is not one of the, of the six counties of Northern Ireland, but you are close enough to actually get a full impact of the Troubles as a neighboring county there. What kind of impact did that have?
We were devastated.
Yeah.
We were devastated. I come from, Buncrana is a border town. So we were 14 miles from what was, to me, our big city, which is the city of Derry. We're 14 miles from Derry. And so everything stopped. We lost tourism. We lost industry. And it was only thanks to people like the McCarter families in Buncrana who came to America, actually, and found Fruit of the Loom to go back and start a factory that we were able to hold on to any industry. So the bottom line is that all of the businesses that I grew up in, that my family was involved in, hotels, bars, all of that sort of stuff, they came to a complete stop. And, maybe in a way, that has had more of an influence on me than anything in the world is having lived in the heart of something that was once thriving, mm-hmm. and then to see it stop in a heartbeat, in a gunshot. It was enough of a lesson for me in life to know that we can never be complacent about the possibilities of things going in the wrong direction. So, without going into the story beyond that much, I can tell you that we as a border county were severely affected by the North. Remember, Northern Ireland is a term used for the political structure within Ulster. Donegal is an Ulster county. We are Ulster counties. And so it's very hard to have, it would be like breaking into somebody's house and saying, there's a ruckus going on in the living room, without realizing that the people, in the kitchen or in the bedrooms or wherever are also affected. So we were affected and continue to be affected. And now holding our breath to see what in God's name is going to happen with the implications of Brexit, because that again brings back the whole issue of the border.
The border, yeah. And I have pretty much beaten it into the ground since the announcement, the brand new announcement this morning, that President Trump is actually going to appoint an American envoy to Northern Ireland. If whoever that is even marginally as successful as, you know, U.S. Senator George Mitchell, put the Good Friday Agreement in place 20 years ago, that's as positive as you can get. Because you don't have to be from Donegal or Mayo or anywhere else in Ireland to know that this is, you know, we spent 20 years talking about the fragility of the Good Friday Agreement, the peace process. But over the last couple of weeks, to see that the very people who, the people of Northern Ireland, that they have put so much into making this a reality, and we could say equally, the leadership of Northern Ireland are as thick as two short planks in walking away from it and saying sorry.
Which is the reason that not one of us can be remotely complacent about this. We must be very active about this to make sure that it does not go back to what it was. But, of course, there have been enormous strides. Our governments are not working against us like they were before 20 years ago.
True.
You have the Irish government. You have the UK government. You have the American government now with this news of an envoy. You have the three governments back saying, let's keep looking at this, just like they did back in the 1980s when we moved towards peace. And for those of us who lived before peace, we know there's a colossal difference between the Ulster of today and the Ulster of the 1970s, 1980s. So we mustn't lose sight of the positive changes that have happened and that the majority of people will want to continue.
Just to end on a note that you and I and many immigrants would have a very clear recollection of, that the Deputy Prime Minister of Ireland, the Taoiseach, would be Simon Coveney, would be coming to New York, would be coming to Washington, and going back with a commitment for a resolution for Northern Ireland is something we couldn't even dream of. If we go back to those days, the Irish government kind of kept very quiet in Dublin, and indeed there were many that were saying, whatever is happening up there, as long as it doesn't dribble down on top of us, we're okay. Almost impossible to comprehend that kind of thing. But the reality of the matter was, most people knew that what they wanted.
Well, Adrian, the one great thing, and I had the pleasure of working on a play a couple of weeks ago called Ulster at Play. It was all about the Northern writers, the Northern voices. The one great thing that we have going for us is that those Northern voices are clear as they've ever been before. We have the voices of Seamus Heaney, the voices of Brian Friel, the voices of Frank McGuinness. We have all of those voices drawing attention to Ulster. Ulster cannot be ignored, because these artists are always telling us the way forward and showing Ireland and the world the way forward.
And I'm glad you brought us to that to your one of your recent plays, that Ulster play, which again at the American Irish Historical Society there in January, and also dear Mr. Beckett at the Irish Council. But I want to you to take us to your arrival in America, like most of us, and, you know, the anticipation of what this new land was going to provide for us. Where did, you know, your compulsion, one might say, to write, to read, to become an author, to be a very strong force, say, in writing for Irish American Magazine, for becoming involved, you know, in community through the arts. Where did that jump out of, or did it jump out of?
Well, Adrian, before I knew it was the arts, to me it was always about stories. It was about storytelling. And I grew up in a family that was very proud of their story, of who they were, and a town and a county that was very proud of their story. And, you know, and that could be called history. But you and I know, and nobody knows it better than you, Adrian, because you are a master storyteller. You and I know the power of story and the power that words can bring to bringing things alive. So for me, it all began, and I'm looking actually as I'm speaking to you on the phone from my office here at home. There's a postcard on the wall here showing my town in Bunclana in 1950s. And there's a photograph of me walking outside my parents' house, the shop. And it was all about the lives of the people in that town and the history of the people in that town. That was the thing that was the most exciting thing ever to me, was stories and storytelling. I didn't know that's what it was called. I just thought it was just, you know, talk.
Yeah.
But it was stories, and it became for me an obsession about history. And again, brings us back to the North. It was the North. It was the Northern history. It was the role and the relationship between the United States and Ireland. It was my uncles and my aunts from West Donegal, which was way down by Kilcar and Killybegs and that part of Donegal, which I felt was more like Ireland than where we were up in Inishowen, because we were more like the UK. We were part of Derry. We were part of that scene. So whenever I go down to my Irish-speaking, Gaelic-speaking grandfather in West Donegal, I thought I was going to Ireland. But anyway, down there, being aware that those aunts and those uncles all went to New York, you know, that had a fascination for me. I didn't think that would be my journey. But it turned out then in the 70s it became my journey. And I landed in New York and I got a job and as a writer in advertising and marketing. But my interest was still very much on Ireland. So I connected with Irish America, the magazine, Irish Echo, the newspaper, because my interest and my commitment was to telling the story of what was going on at home and trying to be useful about that story, as well as I enjoyed the story so much, and I still enjoy the story. But, and of course, all of these stories, as in my experience, led me to the one big story, which was what was the result of the Irish famine on Ireland and on America. And that's become, for me, one of the leading stories that I continue to investigate and tell, which brings us to what I've been doing the last couple of years.
And again, we have worked together with a great number of people in the Irish community to address a topic. One that indeed was well ignored, and ignored for a good reason. Not as much here as in Ireland. God knows we had, you know, we are survivors, the Survivors Guilt,
right.
All of that kind of stuff was, you know, and for many continues to be something that belongs in the history books back there. Let somebody else deal with it.
Right, no, but Adrian, let me just say, I just want to tell you a little story. because God knows you, you're one of my heroes, because you got the Irish, the Famine Memorial created and built for all ages, which is a magnificent achievement. And you have planted right in the heart of Manhattan the greatest monument ever to the history of the Irish famine. So my congratulations to you on that.
Yeah, small comment and a big deal. Go ahead.
Let me tell you my little famine story, Adrian. And this didn't really come alive for me until many years later. I was doing my work here in New York, and as you know, being very involved in the Founding Museum at Quinnipiac and so on and so forth. But when I was growing up, my grandmother owned a small, beautiful little cottage in Donegal, in Buncrana, called McGinn Cottage. And it had been the home of Bishop Edward McGinn, who was the Bishop of Derry and Donegal back in the 1840s at the height of the famine. And in the garden today, my cousin John and his wife Joan own that house and live in that house with their children and grandchildren all around them. And it's a beautiful place. In the garden of that home is a famine pot that Bishop McGinn used at the height of the famine to feed the people of Buncrana and Donegal who needed to be fed. Now, as a child, we played with that pot. If we had had skateboards, we would have skateboarded in that pot. But we played with it and was, you know, full of water and what have you. Yeah. But it was in the garden. It wasn't until I was working on stories about St. Patrick's Cathedral, which, as you know, I was involved in two or three years ago for the restoration of the cathedral, that I was in the archives of the archdiocese. And the archivist there, a young woman, Kate Ferry, said to me, "Turla, are you interested in any letters that we have here in the archives from a Bishop McGinn in Buncrana?" I said, "You're kidding me. Let me see those." And there were letters written from that bishop, from McGinn Cottage in Buncrana, thanking the people of New York for sending money, thanking John Hughes specifically, our other great hero, thanking John Hughes for sending money so they could buy Indian meal to feed the people. So, Adrian, that's my story, almost in a full sweep.
Maybe that's a good portion of your story, but I am very interested in knowing, and I think that might bring it back 3 years ago to your own research and, you know, into St. Patrick's Cathedral. And one might say, okay, you have... you know, our mutual friend, Dr. Maureen Murphy, but the story of the Sisters of Charity of New York and their involvement, not just in being, you know, the saviors for young immigrants, primarily young women coming from Ireland to New York, but their role in establishing what we would know as parochial schools, the parochial school system, which, in fact, many times would say, what a great bishop that was, what a great cardinal.
Right.
And the truth of the matter was that the history of the Sisters of Charity became kind of a tagline. Now, well, you know, they were a big help. You have straightened that out in no uncertain terms. And it was high time somebody would do it. You do it through your writings, through your plays. Bring us to that point and the significance that was overlooked with the passage of time and with the male bastion of Society of Mother Church. Bring us to that.
Well, you know, one of the great rewards for doing this kind of work is that you come up against something that's really magnificent. You come up against something that's so big and true and really speaks to the most, you know, beautiful part of humanity. for me, when I was invited to work on an exhibition about the history of the St. Patrick's Cathedral, I had known about John Hughes, Archbishop Hughes. I had known he was important. I didn't know why. I saw his home, which is preserved in the Ulster American Folk Park in County Tyrone, and what have you. So I started investigating Archbishop Hughes, and I ended up writing a play about Archbishop. First of all, I did an exhibition about the building of the cathedral. And the cathedral was Hughes's great vision for this new population. To get to the heart of Hughes, it's enough to say that when the famine Irish arrived in New York in the height of the 1840s, Black 47, 1847, they had, when they arrived here, on their knees, hundreds of thousands of them, desolate, abandoned, orphaned. They had in New York a champion who had already been working here for 20 years, and his name was John Hughes from Omagh, or from Gorton. Not Gorton, I've got it wrong. Anyway, from Ulster, County Tyrone area, County Monaghan. John Hughes was already the fourth bishop of New York, very young guy. He was in his, like, 40s at that point. And the Irish came into the city destitute. And Hughes, because he was Ulster-born, because he had suffered under the penal laws in Ireland, because he had been refused to be educated, he had been refused an education in Ireland, as he says, for the first 5 days of my life, I had the full benefits of the empire, but then I was baptized. So Hughes knew all about discrimination. So he was determined that the Irish who were coming in would not suffer the way anymore. And he galvanized them. He politicized them. He urbanized them. But he did it with the help of his sister, who was a sister of charity, and her name was Angela Hughes. And a small group of women who had come up from Maryland, from the convent of Mother Seton, St. Elizabeth Seton, to help them. And they opened the first school on Prince Street, down beside what was the first St. Patrick's Cathedral on Mott and Mulberry Street. So it was my work on that exhibition, on that history, on Hughes' story himself. I wrote a play about John Hughes called The Wars of Dagger John.
The Wars of Dagger John. And actually, that was, again, a great play that was last November at the Sheen Center. I don't think we can move on without, perhaps referring to his nickname, which many would say he absolutely deserved. He was Dagger John.
He was Dagger John, and you can read that in a couple of ways. He was a fighter, but people only recognized John Hughes as being a fighter. He was a fighter, but he was also a skilled diplomat. He was appointed by Abraham Lincoln to go to Europe to keep France and England out of the Civil War. He was a skilled diplomat. He was a great writer. I have books on his by Hughes over here on my shelf that are, the shelf could break with these books that he has written. He was erudite. He was a master speaker. He would come to the cathedral, and thousands of people would come to hear him. They came to hear him the week before he died, when he asked them to stop rioting during Civil War riots, and that's the whole story. But my work with Hughes led me to the women who worked with Hughes, and the women who worked with Hughes were the Sisters of Charity of New York, and their work in going out on the main areas of education, on health, orphanages, hospitals, the great St. Vincent's Hospital of New York, which served New York through two centuries of devastation from the Civil War period through the different epidemics, the shirt factory fire in New York, even the Titanic survivors were brought there. And then, of course, the great chapter of the history of that place was the AIDS department at St. Vincent was the leading AIDS hospital in the East Coast and across America for so many years. And then finally at 9/11, where they stood by waiting to help, but nobody came. And we all know how sadly why nobody came, because people had been devastated already. But the Sisters of Charity and the St. Vincent's Hospital, major part of New York history, all of the schools that went out and peopled the schools, and it's their work. I put together an exhibition and a play about them called How the Nuns of New York Tamed the Gangs of New York, and that has been playing down at the Sheen Center. And thanks to you, Adrian, we get an opportunity to mention that it continues to play. On Wednesday, it'll be up there again.
Right, on the 28th.
With an outreach to high schools.
And again, you're, as a playwright, as an author, as a distinguished writer, and I might add rhetorically that, you know, as a marketing and as a PR expert, to bring this to New York. It's, of course, How the Nuns of New York Tamed the Gangs of New York, directed by George Heston, and produced, created by yourself. You bring in the music, the song, the dance, the celebration through music, dance, and story into a period and into an area that we only see as gloom and doom,
right,
with very little attention paid to the tremendous survivorship and the role of the sisters, of the nuns, and in fact for the Catholic Church too,
and the role of education. I mean, Adrian, if you'd ask me, in a, you know, why are we doing this? We're doing this because the Irish are the example. We are the example of how you can come through these devastations and keep your culture intact. We are the first great immigrant body. This play that will show on Wednesday will be to a packed house of young, all girls from St. Raymond's Academy in the Bronx are coming down. And these are children of immigrants. There are many Hispanic, African-American, and they are coming because the one thread in this show is that we are saying to immigrants and to children of immigrants that with education, you become a full American citizen. You get the best of America, and you get the best of life. The people who have come to this country looking for a full experience of humanity have that possibility. And the Sisters of Charity were the first to really show us the way. Now, the teachers in public school helped along the way, too. We have a great historian now who's just taken over Glucksmith Ireland House. Her name is Dr. Hasia Diner. And she has written, you know, in the 1980s, she wrote about how these young Irish women were the first vanguard of teachers in the public schools. And they taught, as Hasia said, and she's the proud head of Jewish studies at NYU before she took over her new job at Ireland House. She talked about how these young Irish women taught these Jewish children how to become American. And then these Jewish children, in turn, were teaching the African Americans in the public schools. So you see the influence of these women throughout history, throughout the history of this of the city, that, you know, that it almost makes you feel like that the Me Too movement of today is an outgrowth of the work that these women have been doing for centuries.
Right. And again, you know, you just mentioned Glucksmith Ireland House there, and on Tuesday, before your own event, on Wednesday and Tuesday, 25 years.
Right.
It doesn't seem like it, but then what does? Of Glucksmith Ireland House at NYU, and
right,
that the theme for now, for this year, is one, again, if it wasn't for the Irish and the Jews, a song resurrected by Mick Maloney, who, again, is very much will be involved not only in Glucksman Ireland House Gala on this Tuesday evening at the Chemist Centre, but also on your own on Wednesday,
right,
the 28th.
We're delighted that Mick and his band, the Greenfields of America,
right,
who are celebrating their 40 years as a troupe of troubadours, will be performing as our guest musicians in our show, Nuns Gang Show, on Wednesday at noon, which, of course, you know, we hope to do again in the future at other times.
Yeah.
Because we really want to reach out to the high school students. And I needn't tell you and your listeners how important it is that we reach out to high school students. We let them know that the theater is their place to be, that the history is,
yes,
there for them as well. And that, you know, this is an opportunity for us to celebrate high school students who desperately need to be, you know, reminded and entertained with their,
absolutely,
own history,
yeah,
and their own tradition.
We only have a minute left, but I would like you to just give us a brief insight into your upcoming play schedule for April.
In April, Adrian, I have the good fortune to be asked by the folks over at Strokestown National Museum, Famine Museum in Ireland, and the Irish Heritage Society in Ireland,
right,
to help coordinate a North American tour of what they call the Great Famine Voices Roadshow. And that is, they're going to cities in North America, in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, New Haven, and then into Canada, Toronto,
okay,
Montreal, collecting memories of people whose family had been impacted by the famine and who have carried those memories through their families. And I know, Adrian, people like you and all the work that you've done on the famine issue, and many of the people I know in my life, and me too, in terms of my famine,
sure,
history, you know, this is an opportunity for us to bring these stories forward so that we can learn, so the world can learn, so that we can avoid these kinds of things happening because of political, you know,
sure,
craziness.
Listen, it's always a delight, and again, I'd like to acknowledge that through the years as a contributor to this program, you're always welcome. Best way to get in touch with you, Charlotte?
The best way, right now, the best way is I have a website.
Good.
And that's TurloMcConnell.com. So if anybody wants to know what I'm up to, they can just have a look at TurloMcConnell.com. .com. And New Yorkers pronounce it Turlo, like Burrow,
yes.
TurloMcConnell.com.
Look forward indeed to meeting you on Wednesday.
And Adrian, thank you and Anya for everything you do to keep us all together through this incredible Irish radio network.
Thank you very much. Okay, friends, Turlo McConnell, and you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, the Flannelly Show, live from New York. We'll be heading over now to Kevin O'Connor in Ireland, who brings us up to date on news and sport. Best way to reach us, friends, at any point is through the internet, info@irishradio.com. That is info@irishradio.com.